Welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable, the weekly podcast with people who definitely don't interrupt several times when you're reading an intro, and also from the Madcap Gang, that's bringing you Free Minds and Free Markets since 1968. I am a slightly bedraggled Matt Welch, joined by a bird-flipping Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mankiw Ward. Hola, amigos.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are and Matt, you know, we're not your children. You can't scare us by shouting at us. off
you
mic.
Can't scare his children okay. by shouting at them either, probably.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't really work.
Yeah, that's why he had to leave California.
We're going to get to America's immigration trolling here in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor, Donors Trust, the tax-friendly way to simplify your charitable giving without compromising your values. Friends, is cancel culture coming for your charitable dollars? Big banks are increasingly reluctant to allow charitable savings accounts, or donor-advised funds, as they are formally called, to direct money toward conservative or libertarian nonprofits. Charities that have been recently rejected by some of the big banks include the Atlas Network, National Review Institute, the National Rifle Association Foundation, Liberty Council, and others. To help ensure that your dollars support your values, let Donors Trust help service your charitable giving. Donors Trust was built to serve people who believe limited government constitutional rights are worth fighting for. If you already have a donor-advised fund, consider opening a rollover account. To learn more, download their prospectus at www.donorstrust.org/reason. That's www.donorstrust.org/reason. Align your giving with your values, Nick Gillespie. You'll be glad you did. Okay. Last week, a whole season of red state immigration policy as own the libs trolling reached a bewildering climax as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis deposited 50 asylum-seeking Venezuelan migrants that he had rounded up in San Antonio, Texas, onto the Tony-if-sleepy Massachusetts vacation island of Martha's Vineyard. There they stayed for 44 hours before being bussed over to Cape Cod, which actually has facilities to absorb them. As fate would have it, would you shut up?
To absorb them? What, are we in the Soylent Green world already?
Can you shut up? As fate would have it, the vineyard stunt took place on the same day that Texas Governor Greg Abbott dropped a busload of migrants at the front gates of Vice President Kamala Harris's residence in Washington, D.C., just blocks away from Reason HQ. Abbott said, try it, Nick. You can do it. We believe in you.
I was going to say, it's also a day after Herschel Walker dropped a bunch of children off, of his children off at a homeless shelter.
Did you preemptively laugh at that joke before you told it? Is that what just happened here?
Do you know who's talking? Let's read a quote from Greg Abbott before I stop talking, because it's pointless. The Biden-Harris administration continues ignoring and denying the historic crisis at our southern border, which has endangered and overwhelmed Texas communities for almost 2 years. Our supposed border czar, Vice President Kamala Harris, has yet to even visit the border to see firsthand the impact of the open border policy she has helped implement, even going so far as to claim the border is secure. Final context, before I kick it to Catherine, Abbott has sent about 8,000 asylum seekers to D.C., 2,500 to New York, 600 to Chicago. Officials at those destinations, just as in Martha's Vineyard, say that the donating border governors, this also includes Arizona, have not been coordinating these drop-offs with recipient cities in any meaningful way. The controversy comes amid an explosion in the number of Border Patrol encounters with migrants crossing the southern border, overwhelming many property owners, towns, and judicial systems. Catherine, the argument in favor of the bus trolling goes something like this. And here, God help me, I am quoting a tweet from not Nick Gillespie's snorting nose, but in fact, somebody named A.G. Hamilton 29. Quote, it's hard not to notice that the national press had almost completely ignored the crisis, including deaths and suffering, and no one called for any changes at the border right until these stunts resulted in the cities where they are based being affected. End quote. Don't the people who say this have a point?
Sure. This has absolutely drawn attention to an ongoing crisis. And I think it's just a question of who you think caused the crisis and what the solution to it is. And that's where everything immediately breaks down and everyone starts screaming at each other in a very unuseful way. So I would say that, the particulars of this busing stunt have probably drawn way too much attention, right? Were the people, you know, sent up consensually? Was this person lied to? Was that person lied to? We are going to be litigating that forever. Maybe literally litigating it, but certainly figuring it out. And I don't think that's the point. The point is, there is a big problem at the border. I would say the problem is the ways in which we are gating entry and forcing people into boxes when they arrive. This flow of people from, say, San Antonio to Martha's Vineyard could occur all on its own. It could occur naturally, and then it would be fine, right? It would be just happening at like a natural rate. It would reflect, in theory, people having some kind of a connection to the place that they were headed, or maybe a job, or at least a theory about how to get a job. Actually, the New York Times had a great piece today, I think, about a Venezuelan who was shipped up on a sort of similar stunt in July to Washington, D.C., who has made good in the city. Even though he was used as a pawn, he also used it as an opportunity and has done really well. I think that this is, in fact, the real story of most of these people, and that, you know, instead we're going to obsess about which governor did which bad thing and whether Martha's Vineyard has enough hotel rooms or whatever the hell. And none of that makes any sense at all. That isn't the point, shouldn't be the point. The thing that I find weird, and maybe we can talk about this is not the first time this has happened. Like, this exact gambit has been done by these exact governors many times before, and it didn't blow up like this. So I'm a little bit confused about why now. If anybody has any theories, I would be interested to hear them.
Martha's Vineyard, Alan Dershowitz, nude beaches. I think that's the answer to a lot of questions.
He's the big winner, right, of all this, though, because for a weekend, he was not the most hated person on Martha's Vineyard.
Nick, you're out there on the internet this week saying that we need
a shoe shine and a smile, Matt Welch.
Saying that we need more immigrants and not less, building on Catherine's point.
Not fewer, Matt. And speak English. If you're going to be in America, speak English.
What would you tell the people who live in southern Texas, who are fishing out bodies from the Rio Grande and their properties being trampled over? How do you what do you say to them, Mr. More Immigrants Guy?
You know, the easiest way to get rid of immigrants at the border is, to build on what Catherine was talking about, is to, you know, facilitate a nobody wants to live at the border, or very few people do. Create an immigration process that actually allows people to enter the country and get to the places they want to go, which, by the way, are where the jobs are. And Alex Narasta of the Cato Institute, who is, the term open borders is always and everywhere a misnomer, but he is somebody who is, you know, in favor of massively increasing legal immigration as a way to deal both with questions of illegal immigration, but also of dying, of labor needs in the country. He points out in a recent piece that the reason why there has been a surge in illegal crossings or crossings of the border, the southern border of the U.S. over the past couple of years, is because of the surge in the labor market. And governments are not good at stopping mass numbers of people from crossing borders when they are moving for, you know, a better life. And that is what is happening here. So we need to recognize that and recognize that, you know, the Biden administration has failed in a fundamental way to reverse and change many of the Trump-era immigration policies and many of the Obama-era immigration policies, unfortunately, as well as Bush. And this is a bipartisan, longstanding, decades-long failure on the part of the federal government to get its shit together and actually create an immigration policy that does not treat, that does not create a black market in immigration, because we know what happens when you do that. You just intensify problems all across the board, both for legal and illegal dealings. So for the people on the border, unfortunately, there is not a quick and simple fix. But what we need to be doing is talking about how do we create an immigration policy that actually works for labor markets, for individuals, and for people in border towns, which again, I will point out, you know, historically and generally, people on the border are doing quite well. They face less crime and less disruption than people in other parts of the country. And I really just need to say what Abbott and DeSantis are doing, and even if they've been trying to, you know, pick this scab for a while, and this is the time where it took off, you know, it's despicable to be doing that, because they are not helping in any meaningful way to create a country where immigration is going to be normalized and regularized and done in a way where we are not incentivizing governments at all levels to start treating human beings as illegal acts and going after them and the businesses that employ them.
Peter, 10 years ago, basically everybody coming north across the Rio Grande was from Mexico. And now that's changed to a startling degree just over the last couple of years. Big jump, especially from Cuba, from Venezuela, Colombia, Nicaragua. You are from Florida, Peter. I have it reliably understood. Have we gotten to the point in Florida politics where owning the libs has trumped even helping out victims of communism?
I think it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I tweeted something to the effect of the future of American politics is just memes battling. And it was a joke, because like some political memes were going around Twitter, and it was all meme politics, it felt like, for like an evening. But now it feels like that every day, and not just on Twitter. And what DeSantis and Abbott are doing here is the equivalent of trying to own the other side with memes, except the memes are people on buses and their real lives. And this is, it's pretty unfortunate, I think. I think in some cases, you know, the New York Times story that Catherine pointed out is really great, and everybody should read it, because it is a story of somebody who chose to get on a bus to Washington, D.C. Of his own volition, and was very happy to have gotten there because he got a job, is sending money back to his family, has plans to buy a car, is working, wants to be part of the productive economy. And I think, you know, that it's not always the case that this is, that some of these, you know, that some of these things are necessarily terrible for the immigrants who end up in other cities after crossing the border. And so it's not that it's always just sort of abusing them. At the same time, there are reports that the Martha's Vineyard plane, that the people who were on it were lied to and misled about where they were going, and that they were sold a bill of goods, you know, in order to get them on the plane. And that's awful. But either way, I don't like that these folks are being used as pawns and as sort of in many cases, it seems unwitting cast members in the enactment of real life memes that don't seem to have any real constructive outcome here, right? Like, does this seem like DeSantis and Abbott are proposing, like, oh, here's what we should do to, you know, like actually have a border policy and sort of make sense of all of this? They're not. They're not at all. I mean, DeSantis in particular, who is not even he's, you know, sort of near Cuba, but like it's not a border state. DeSantis in particular has just not been forthcoming with what he wants to do with regards to policy in a lot of areas, but immigration in particular. And this just doesn't seem productive to me, and it doesn't seem like it bodes well for the future of American politics.
Speaking of which, Catherine, let's read you a tweet. This one comes from Senator John Cornyn, whose name is so mispronounceable. Comes from a couple of days ago. He's from Texas. Here we go. Aiding and abetting the drug deaths of 108,000 Americans last year alone because of the hashtag Biden border crisis is simply reckless and wrong. And then he adds at the end, at Fentanyl Joe.
I hate it. I hate it. There's so much stupid in there, including we don't use hashtags like that anymore. But yeah,
hashtag. Yeah, we do.
Yeah, come on.
No, we don't. We only use them ironically. Okay.
Fentanyl Joe.
I guess that was it. Anyway. Yeah. There is obviously a bunch of misunderstandings in there. The first of which is the idea that somehow our drug problem would vanish, and we do have problems with drugs, that it would vanish if we could fully control the border. That's absurd. We make drugs here in America. Gosh darn it. Like God intended.
Some of the best drugs ever.
Like USA forever, etc. And the idea that what is happening with this, and I do think the word stunt really is the right word. I mean, we've settled on that and it's perfect. The stunt with, you know, busing immigrants to Kamala Harris's house or whatever, it has nothing to do with the drug war. Truly nothing at all. It has everything to do with electoral politics, first of all. And if we want to send a message to Fentanyl Joe, this is an absurd way to do it. So yes, once again, thank you, Matt, for bringing to my attention. Like, I'm on Twitter all the time, but I think my brain or else my algorithm has developed like some protective mechanisms because I never see these before you ambush me with them on the pod. It's like the fresh wound, right? Just bleeding before our listeners. It's really cruel.
Nick, you've been writing about and steering the magazine's coverage about immigration for a really long time. Through a lot of different kind of spasms of discussion about it. Is it your impression that the discourse around it, by that I specifically mean sort of like the factual understanding of what is happening and why and what it means, regardless of what one thinks about should happen, but just like the commonly agreed upon set of facts is worse now than back when you started doing this?
You know, that's a really fascinating thing to kind of ask about and to pick up on part of what Catherine, I think, was getting at. Like, yeah, I think so. I think we're further removed from anything that we would call a shared reality. But I think it's not simply immigration. I think it's increasingly more and more political issues. But I think possibly what is the, you know, really awful about it when it comes to immigration is that, you know, we are talking about actual individual people here. We're not talking about anything as abstracted out as, you know, tax laws and things like that. And so that the thing that is being erased is, you know, really front and center and particularly disturbing. But there is, you know, there is very little, if you ask people how many immigrants come legally to the country every year, how many come illegally, what is going on? There is, it's like discussions of crime. It seems completely divorced from any kind of, you know, grounding in empirical reality, which I think is really troubling. And as equally troubling is the idea that border crises, you know, variously defined, and larger immigration flows are tightly linked. This is also a problem because we have been going now for decades without the kind of comprehensive immigration reform that might actually get us to a point where we are in a good situation regarding immigration and not controlling the flows, but kind of rolling with the flows and, you know, where people who want to move to America and work and live legally can do that. Employers who want to employ them, you know, can do that legally. And, you know, the rest of us who are long, you know, have been here forever also benefit from, you know, the increases in immigration, which is, you know, there are few things that are win-win in the world. And increased immigration flow of, you know, legal immigration, which can be done very quickly in terms of, you know, changing the laws and then starting working through the system. This is a win-win. Everybody, you know, and I've lived in parts of the country that have low immigration and are super anti-immigrant. They're not doing so well. And I've lived in other parts of the country where there's high immigration and people are anti-immigrant. They're doing better. And the very best people are the ones who live in the parts of the country that are pro-immigrant and have a lot of immigration.
I'm sympathetic to the people who say, listen, at the border right now, stuff is not right. I mean, to the extent that the whole point of this was to make people who don't live at the border aware of the fact that the border is different and worse than it historically has been, like, congratulations, you did it. You did not do it in a way that will get us even one step closer, I don't think, to actually solving that problem. But it is it. You know, I think those of us who are pro-immigration do sometimes hand wave the kind of traffic jam experience or the you know, the kind of experience of people stuck in a bureaucracy at the border and say, like, well, that would resolve if we legalized all of it. I think that's true. But the fact remains that right now we are in a situation with pretty messed up gray markets in immigration. We are in a situation with like very, very severe border restrictionism that results in people getting stuck there, people who are trying to get in line. And we've, of course, talked many times on this podcast back that there is no line. People who are trying their best to get in line and wind up stuck in a box near the border, whether they're remaining in Mexico or coming into the U.S. And they do impact the quality of life of Americans who want to live right there. That is the fault of the government, though, and not the fault of the immigrants themselves, surely, or of immigration as a concept.
Peter, you were going to say something.
One of the reasons we have high inflation right now is that there are serious labor supply shortages, especially in a lot of big cities, and especially for hourly wage work, often low or medium skilled hourly wage work of the kind that, frankly, immigrants who have crossed thousands of miles in order to come to the United States are ideally suited for. And like, this seems like here is a problem that could be fixed by a better, smarter, more humane immigration system that says, hey, look, we've got all these people who want to come here and work, and we've got all these jobs that employers can't fill. And for whatever reason, we can't seem to find a political consensus on doing that, or at least a political consensus on doing that in a way that makes any kind of sense and allows it to happen above board.
One of the interesting little bits from the Bureau of Labor Statistics I was going down and researching a couple of weeks back. If you hive off different age categories and ethnic race categories, the highest share of the group, the cohort that has the highest share of employment are Hispanic males in this country. It's almost as if they interview on this fun podcast called Los Libertinos. This guy is from San Antonio, named Carlos Abelar, I believe it is. And Nick, you'll appreciate this. I was
hates Gene Mock.
He's only 15 years younger than me, and he'd never heard the stereotype of Mexicans being lazy. It was just it's just incomprehensible. Yeah, really? Yeah,
that's kind of awesome.
I had to tell him about Peggy Lee's Manana. It was all new to him. It's amazing how much that is flipped. And Peter, you're absolutely right. Like, it's as if the solution's right in front of your face. It's frustrating to watch people not.
It would be interesting and kind of great to see it would be interesting and great to see a bunch of pro-immigration governors say fuck you to DeSantis and Abbott and say, yes, send them here. Jared Polis, who I talked to earlier in the year, talked about, exactly what Peter was saying, that if you want to help combat inflation, we should be bringing in more immigrants. Jared Polis in Colorado, Gavin Newsom in California, there are other people, including, I'm sure, red state governors.
Utah's very welcoming.
Yeah, they should be saying, you know what, we'll take them. And especially, when you're talking about these Venezuelans, too, it's like these people have been processed. They're in the country legally. They can't work for various reasons. That's a bureaucratic problem. But these are people who have been vetted, which is what people who are worried about illegal immigration are always worried about. These people have been vetted. Let them come and work in the country. The other thing I wanted to do, Matt, was just plug the interview that I did with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick about their documentary series that is running out on PBS over the first week. First episode came out on Friday, over the next 2 weeks, called The U.S. and the Holocaust. And what's interesting about that show in particular is that it begins and ends with the fact that Otto Frank, Anne Frank's father, tried to emigrate to the United States in the early 30s and was not able to. Because of 20s era immigration restrictions that were put in place that essentially killed immigration from Europe for Jews, certainly, but also Italians and other unwanted groups. And, putting immigration restriction in a proper historical, social, political context is really important because it is the ugliest side of American kind of exceptionalism. And it is, you know, watching that series, and you can start by watching the interview that I did, which gets into it. You know, America's only immigration problem is that we do not have enough immigrants. We should be welcoming people to come here to work and live legally and to add and to change what America is like in the way that we have changed radically over the past 100 years and have become a better country for it.
All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Friends, when you're stressed out, overwhelmed, facing an immediate challenge or three, like, say, a complicated editing assignment that's really past being due, do you tend to focus more on the problem or on the solution? People tend to get reactive while under duress, but therapists are there to help them reset their brains into proactive, problem-solving machines. This is what BetterHelp.com can do for you. BetterHelp is customizable online therapy, super convenient and affordable, and ready right now to set you up with a professional counselor to help train your brain into an organ that assists rather than a system that overloads. Here's what you do. Go to BetterHelp.com/roundtable, fill out a brief questionnaire, match up with a licensed therapist, and already get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder, send your queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from beloved listener and Reason Cruise veteran, Scott Ewine. I hope I'm mangling that in some
God,
way.
God, you stop. Wait, no, it's Ewine.
Ewine?
Eh. Yeah.
Ewine. He writes, Reason Roundtable. Many institutions seem to have lost their way recently, often due to audience or donor capture. On the left, the ACLU has lost its free speech absolutism, now thinks some speech is not worth protecting. NPR has become a sad, woke, unlistenable parody of its former self. God has it. On the right, Catherine's former employer, the Weekly Standard, went under when the editors and financial backers went different ways regarding Trump. Reason has been very consistent for the past 50 plus years, with the possible exception of that piece by Matt Welch praising France's healthcare system. How was the magazine of free market, Free Minds and Free Markets? How has, sorry, I can read, the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets been so consistent and done so well for so long? And more importantly, what is being done to ensure its continued success, principal commitment to libertarian ideas? P.S. I will be attending Reason's space-themed Halloween party in a sexy Nick Gillespie astronaut costume. Catherine, I'm sorry that the last part of the email absolutely ruined the first part, but why are we so pretty?
Is Gitmo still open?
We are so pretty. I love a question that's like, why are you so great? It's my favorite kind of question. So I think the simple mechanics of it are just that by never having really been on one side or the other in American tribal politics, we are less tempted than others to compromise our principles when the things that constitute our tribe change. Now, I suppose there is arguably a change afoot right now about what constitutes libertarianism in this country, if you are at all on the Twitter machine. But I feel pretty confident in Reason's vision, and so do the people on staff. And I think that at least one answer to how come Reason has been so consistent and so principled is because the same people who founded this damn thing are still hanging around, and also everyone who came after them. And, you know, that's maybe not like a
she says
scalable strategy, yeah, but it's great. I'm not bitter at all. I think it's actually really, really good for institutions to have their founding fathers lurking. And the fact that Bob Poole is just out here dropping emails and still doing work on transportation policy is absolutely a plus. Manny Klausner, of course, still helping us with the occasional legal brief for funsies, as well as serving on our board. And these very gentlemen here on this podcast, Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie.
Reporting for duty.
Still lurking like the ghosts of Christmas past in the bodies of Stadler and Waldorf to keep Reason steady as she goes. It's all good. And I think that, you know, I think that we, it is true that lots of lots of the kind of once commonalities that we had with other political people of other political persuasions or other political parties have left us, right? Like the left has abandoned civil liberties, the right has abandoned free markets, if either of them ever really supported either of those things. And so maybe that has a way also of kind of keeping us together and consolidating what we see as the very important mission to defend those things.
Nick, what's your lurker's position?
I'm flattered by the question. And even as I question Scott Ewine's Halloween costume proclivities, which seem to be getting worse.
He already bought the wig is the key. He already has the Nick Gillespie wig. And so now he's just trying to.
I want to point out, by the way, you know, I get nothing out of that. I don't get any royalties or anything. So, you know, please go to my website and buy the official wig. But
Sexy Space Gillespie parens Gillespie's
that's
version.
Right. .edu. But you know, I think it's a great question because what it means to be libertarian has changed radically over the past 50 years for many people in the movement, many people who call themselves that. And I like to think that reason is staying true to free minds and free markets, and that we are trying to do the work that Hayek and other people talked about, which is that, you know, we have a set of principles, not a set of policy prescriptions that remain static over time, regardless of changing circumstances. And when you're trying to apply, you know, what does it mean to be in favor of maximum individual liberty and of, you know, free minds and free markets, it changes and it makes it hard. Also, because, you know, like if you are anti-Trump and anti, you know, Biden, there's, you know, in this tribal landscape, in this darkling plain, you know, where the ignorant armies of the night clash, Matt Welch, it can be a little bit lonely.
Peter, you live in D.C. You have certainly gazed upon the political-ish media landscape and think tanky world. What are your sober reflections on how we have navigated those waters?
I think the short answer to Scott's question is because we're right and we keep being right.
Wow.
Damn.
Spike the football. I'm going to give an institutional answer, structural answer. This is something I write every year or every other year when we're doing our webathon, our annual fundraising exercise, in which we've raised at this point $500,000 a year, including from a lot of roundtable listeners. So thank you for that. But we usually do it in late November, early December. The structure of magazines of opinion are important, the ownership structure. There's basically three different ways to do this. One, and this not just magazines of opinion, but also opinion sections of newspapers. One is that you get someone rich to subsidize you and hope he doesn't get mad at you. This is time-honored. This has been basically the New Republic's model for almost all of its star-crossed history. This is great until the rich person notices that it doesn't make money. You can count the number of opinion journalism outlets that make money on subscriptions and advertising revenue on, I think, no hands or maybe one hand, depending on how you measure a couple of things. So you need to have it subsidized in some way. So it's either the rich guy doesn't mind losing money, or you can organize a nonprofit but have it dominated by another rich guy who doesn't mind losing money and throwing money. And then you're basing it on the whims of that individual. Reason became a nonprofit, I think, like in 1980, early 80s. And then the foundation really arose around it in the late 80s. And that created a structure around it so that it was never really dominated by a single person. If you get a big and vigorous board that's also very collegial and is buying into a vision that was already well established, first by Lanny Friedlander, but especially by Bob Poole and Mandy Klausner and Tibor McCann, you know, this thing existed. Everyone had been reading it for 20 years before they got into the board. So they kind of knew how it was. You weren't going to like suddenly redirect it in some vast new direction because it didn't make sense to do that. That wasn't your attraction to it to begin with. So we are, and especially through the webathon, that's really super helpful for us because it spreads the risk. right? The more donors that we have, even on a small level, the more insulated we are from that. And after that, it's just a matter of execution and talent picking and the usual organizational stuff. And it certainly helps that the exact locations of a lot of the media's nervous breakdown, beginning really in the summer of 2020, but in other times as well, are things that we have been writing about critically and not participating in. So we, you know, knock on wood, we seem to be doing all right with that. I don't know, Catherine, if you want to edit or revise any of my remarks there. Otherwise, we can move on.
I always do, but I detected no mixed metaphors, so we'll let it pass.
Fair enough. All right. Joe Biden, Joseph Robin Biden II, gave an interview to 60 Minutes on Sunday. There are approximately two pieces of news from this interview. We might even get to both. But the first one was that the president declared that the pandemic is over. That was a direct quote. The pandemic is over. A lot of people are losing their marbles over this. Apparently, these were not this was not a prepared part of his remarks. And so people are scrambling to backfill and all this kind of stuff. Peter, I'm curious, as someone who's followed COVID policy a lot and bureaucratic bits and who lives in Washington and is from Florida, are there implications if the president says the pandemic is over? Are there implications to, I don't know, policy directives that he in particular has given or that whole swaths of government have taken?
Well, it does make me kind of worry. I think this is like the presidential equivalent of one of those New York Times trend pieces that like notices something that's been happening for like 10 years. And finally, they're like, "Ooh, a reporter found three examples." And so they're declaring that pants are different now, except wait, no, those at the exact moment that they declare that pants are different, new pants come in, and you can't rely on the New York Times for this sort of thing. And I'm not sure you can rely on Biden. It makes me worry that actually the pandemic is happening again. Maybe no. I would say the biggest single thing that strikes me about this is we've all known this for a long time that like in terms of disruptions to our daily lives, the pandemic has been over for a while. And it's great to hear Biden say that, but it is somewhat complicated when you just implemented a gigantic student loan forgiveness program, the legality of which is predicated on the notion that we are in an emergency pandemic that allows the president to make use of post 9/11 security laws to forgive the $10,000 or $20,000 worth of student loan debt to millions of people. And so, like, that was always an incredibly dubious argument that was just sort of tacked on at the end. Nobody really believed it. As I have noted on this podcast before, 1 year prior to Biden announcing the student loan forgiveness program, Nancy Pelosi flatly said on the record that the president cannot do that. It is illegal. And there was no caveat to it. There was no hedging or waffling or anything. Nancy Pelosi stated what everybody who has looked at the law understood up to that point, which is the president does not have this authority. Well, they found that authority in this post 9/11 law, basically designed to allow for the executive branch to forgive some student loans for like 9/11 first responder types. And then they decided to expand that to everybody because we're in an emergency pandemic still. Well, if we're not in an emergency pandemic, then where does the president get the authority? I think the answer is he doesn't have it. He never had it. And they just don't want to bother with it. It's obviously a pretext and it should go to court. It's just not clear who has standing to sue at this point. But it does suggest that the administration's position on this sort of thing has some internal contradiction problems.
Catherine, you live in DC. Are there still at this late date, a couple of signs that the pandemic is not indeed over when it comes to the policy enacted by certain Democratic Party dominated governments?
Yeah, it is funny how those things still are lurking around, even though I swear to God, I heard the president say the pandemic was over. It was the weirdest thing. So I don't know, man. You know, like wine moms who have like the live, laugh, loves and stuff on their walls. Sometimes you get like a like a sassier wine mom who has the a lack of planning on your part doesn't constitute an emergency on my part one. And I've been thinking about that a lot with respect to all these emergency declarations, because it's like, I didn't figure out the student loan crisis. So I guess now it's this one's still an emergency, but the other one is not an emergency anymore. We still have some emergencies on the books. As Suderman has noted, they tend to hang around. Some like official declarations of emergency for a long, long time. But, you know, it's going to be fine. And DC is mostly moving on from its emergency status, even as the president urges us.
Nick, is there any final lesson that we should learn from the even concept of emergencies being declared? Did we over emergency to the point where, like, we should just remove emergencying as a tool of government?
Oh, I mean, Matt, as you may well remember from a different timeline when we wrote a book called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America, I recommend the paperback edition, which has added new material. But it is absolutely stunning. The entire 21st century, governing is an exercise in emergency powers. From supplemental spending on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, that characterized the Bush administration to a bunch of things in under Obama, Trump, and now Biden. The big takeaway for me, I guess, is that pants are over. It's going to be a little bit complicated given that we're moving into colder weather here in New York City. But I'm glad to hear that President Biden agrees with the New York Times and Peter Suderman that pants are over.
Actually, the Times had a trend story just a couple of days ago about the new one is that the kids are unbuttoning the top button of their pants. Because they're like, you know what? It's not that I'm fat. It's just it's sexy. It's sexy. I'm not bursting at the seams.
I mean, you know, in my day, we wore our pants backwards. Pants?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. But
remember crisscross?
No, crisscross. Oh, my God. They literally created riots when they did that. Crisscross.
Kids
They were playing the Jersey Shore. People went bananas.
Kids used to be dragged out of my elementary school class and forced to put their pants on forwards. I mean, it was real.
My God. They're like minimum security prisons schools. Thank you, Joe Biden.
I think it's just news that kids are wearing buttons on their pants. Like, didn't we all move to stretchy drawstring pants 2 years ago? No?
You did, old man. Mm.
Peter.
Obviously, not all of us, but...
I
will say, yes. I did take a COVID test over the weekend because on Sunday morning, I was feeling a little droopy or whatever. And I was like, I wonder if I have COVID. And, you know, I have, this is when I knew COVID was over, is when I bought like 20 COVID tests because, you know, I'll never use them. And I'm still waiting, President Biden, if you're listening, I'm still waiting for the COVID tests that were being sent for free to people.
Oh, right.
If you remember that. Yeah, that, you know, I'm sure I'll get those once my cancer diagnosis.
So they actually discontinued that program just within the last couple of weeks. Because they did not have enough supply left because they had screwed up the ordering in advance of the fall flu and COVID season.
My God. Or maybe they were dumping them into the National Gas Reserve.
I'm packing to take a COVID test as soon as we're done recording this. Just, I think I got it from Nick. There's one other piece of news from that interview, and I'll just get Nick's reaction to it. Which is that Biden said that he hasn't yet fully decided that he was running in 2024 for re-election. One of the responses to that bit of news has come from California Governor Gavin Newsom, who has said, if I am totally running, if he doesn't run, I'm in it to win it. Here we go. So, Nick, how excited are you about the prospect of Gavin Newsom versus Ron DeSantis?
That is going to be a clarifying moment for the country. And, you know, suddenly the idea of a national divorce or maybe, you know, it starts to make sense to me. But what a fascinating value proposition, Gavin Newsom versus Ron DeSantis. I think that typifies the problem with the duopoly, though. Which is that so you're going to have a right wing version of an authoritarian governor who is more than happy to shut down speech that he doesn't like and to go after lifestyles he doesn't like, to go after businesses he doesn't like, versus Gavin Newsom, who is just, you know, an off the charts failure. He is a throwback to a different, dumber America. You know, we'll look forward to that. And I also want to thank you, Matt Welch, for watching 60 Minutes so the rest of us don't have to.
I the only one who is just terrified by the 2024 electoral prospects? I mean, on the Republican side, it looks like it's pretty much either DeSantis or Trump. And on the Democratic side, it's going to be Biden if he wants to run. And if he doesn't, then it's probably Newsom or Kamala Harris. This does not seem like a pleasant set of choices for libertarians.
I think the you know, there's the Libertarian Party, which could offer a bold alternative to that. But I'm curious to see if, in fact, it's Newsom on the Democratic side, whether or not Jared Polis of Colorado steps up and presents an alternative to, I think, you know, and it would not be a libertarian alternative, although there would be libertarian elements to it, but to a, you know, a pro-business, pro-immigration, pro-free markets, pro-free speech vision of governance that we haven't really seen in many, many ways in a long time.
And he was less handsy with the lockdowns, especially compared to Gavin Newsom, who was still putting yellow emergency tape over playgrounds in December of 2020.
Never stop being furious about that, Matt. I love your rage about that because it is so messed up.
It's nice. California's nice. Like, you want to go outside. That's good for you. It's good for you, especially the pandemic. All right. Let's get to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in terms of cultural product. Catherine, do you want to lead us off?
I do. As we have mentioned on this podcast, Reason is working on our once in a decade or so space issue for an upcoming issue. And as a consequence, I rewatched all of Firefly. So that's a thing that libertarians have opinions about. Obviously, we like it because it just has a great anti-government message, right? For those who somehow have lived under a rock in 2002, which is when it aired, Jesus Christ, a long time ago.
Wow-wee.
It's a space western. It's great because it's like interplanetary smuggling, but also horses and train heists. And there's a sexy lady and bad government goons. And it's just absolutely delightful. One season, they were just totally screwed over by Fox, which aired the episodes out of order and then canceled it mid-season. So,
wow.
Here's the thing. Libertarians love it because it has libertarian themes and messaging, but they also love it, I think, because even though the powers that be did their best to keep this scrappy little show down, people found it and loved it and gave it a life despite all of that. And so it also gives people just like hope for libertarianism to go the same way that Firefly went. Here's the thing, though. I rewatched it and it turns out TV has gotten so much better. TV's gotten like really, really, really better. And it's maybe not that good. Like, the concept is still really good. And I will give Joss Whedon credit that he did do diverse casting kind of before that was a thing, and in a way that makes sense for the plot, which I really appreciated. Like, it's like a post-ethnicity future. The Anglo-Sino Alliance or whatever is out there swearing in Mandarin, and it's great. It doesn't look that good, and the acting and cinematography is excruciating. I don't know. I remembered it being better than it was. And I think that my optimistic spin on that is that TV just got better, like a lot better, way, 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 way better. Also, the show was not designed to binge, and I did watch the whole thing back to back, which just like made yet another like soft focus sequence in the courtesan's space shuttle, like more painful. But the of course terrifying message to draw from this is like, what does this mean for libertarianism? It's not as good as it looked 20 years ago. I guess I'll let you do the math there. I was depressed after I watched it, is what I'm saying.
Was Matt, is it just me, or did Catherine seem to be talking as like a 13 or 14 year old girl as she was talking, remembering?
I was not 13 in 2002, just for the record.
All right. But your enthusiasm was de-ageifying. You were as de-ageified as Robert De Niro in The Irishman, you were speaking of fire.
The libertarian elements in that show came mostly not from Joss Whedon, but from the other co-creator, Tim Minear. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name. And the real disappointment for me is that he never got to make his adaptation of The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, which he had started working on in the mid-aughts, and it never, of course, got made.
I just am now nervous about whether when I travel back in time and watch my libertarian show that was reincarnated after it was summarily canceled, Bosom Buddies. Whether that's holding up, Nick.
I thought you were going to go with CPO Sharky, Matt.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, but Bosom Buddies led to Turner and Hooch, the greatest dog detective movie ever.
Oh, I think, but you can draw a straight line from Bosom Buddies to Drag Queen Story Hour, too.
Yes.
I mean, I think that might be the beginning of the end. Yeah.
Nick, what did you consume?
Speaking of going back in time, I subscribed to Cream, America's only rock and roll magazine, which had been missing for decades. And this was a Detroit-based low-end rock magazine in the 70s and 80s, I guess. I was reading it probably towards the end of the 70s. And it there's a good documentary about it. It was a place where people like Lester Bangs and Dave Marsh and other kind of grungy, gritty rock critics actually, they were fans first. So they attacked the people that they loved as well as loved the people they attacked. Cream magazine is back and it's fantastic. The current issue, the new issue, came with a special add-on magazine devoted to David Bowie, and there's an IMAX movie called Moon Age Daydream out about David Bowie that I'm dying to see. But what Cream is doing in its current iteration is it's mining its own archives. So in the special magazine that came within the magazine, they have a bunch of original reviews of Bowie's, classic albums and things like that. That's fantastic. Matt, there's a great piece about Crazy Horses, Osmond's hard rock record from early 70s that everybody has forgotten about.
Everybody fantastic. Except the person who has it on vinyl. Thank you very
much. Okay, there you go. Yeah, on that like 200 milligram vinyl that's too thick to play on regular turntables. But and then they also are doing good new stuff. They have an interesting feature on a band called Special Interest as well. So I highly recommend if you like rock and roll, which is as much an attitude as it is a type of music, check out the new iteration of Cream, and that's CREEM, America's only rock and roll magazine.
It was a thing to be a Southern California kid and like try to bum around Hollywood Boulevard in the hair metal 80s and pick up your copy of Cream and devour every last bit of it. Suderman, what did you
I've been reading the novel Cult Classic by Sloan Crosley. It's a contemporary romantic thriller with psychological elements about a former magazine editor in New York who is in her late 30s, who suddenly inexplicably starts running into all of her exes. Like every single night, there's a new one, often in the same small set of blocks in Lower Manhattan, and she can't quite figure out why. And it turns out, I don't want to say too much, but the word cult is in the title. And also, she used to work at a magazine titled Modern Psychology for a guy who became kind of like a psychological TV guru self-help type. And he, it turns out, is conducting experiments in social media manipulation and energy, direction, and thought, and making all of her exes show up, like, not really knowing that that's what they're doing, so that she just bumps into them. The idea being that this will help her find closure as she moves forward with her engagement to a nice guy who goes to the gym and drinks beer and is a professional glass blower. Anyway, it's a funny, amusing, and like really well-paced and written, quite observant story of like New York dating and the like sort of post-apocalypse of like the old magazine era, because she now works at like this sort of content farm and has just decided like, well, you know, magazines are over. I wanted to be like a big ticket journalist and like, you know, the old kind of glossy world. But maybe I'll just write listicles for a living and that'll be okay.
I think there's a lot of interesting subtext there. Peter, that you can work out at betterhelp.com. This,
so far, all three of these recommendations are just like pure, pure psychological self-revelation. It's dark times. Go ahead, Matt. Bring us home.
Yeah, Matt, come on. Tell us what 1940s movie did you watch? Casablanca.
I've been going through a run of documentaries with my seven-year-old, and she has a specific strong interest in kind of ancient civilizations that were once incredibly grand. And so we hadn't really seen one that nailed it and still haven't right between the eyes about Egypt. We've seen some decent ones, some good ones. The one that we watch on Netflix, it's called The Secrets of the Saqqara Tomb, S-A-Q-Q-A-R-A. It came out in 2020. It's about the discovery and exhumation of a gigantic tomb that's 4,400 years old, one of the biggest, most significant find in at least a half a century. And they kind of walk you through it as people are painstakingly trying to figure out the hieroglyphics and decipher what this means. And they got to do that before they dig the shaft and see what's at the bottom. And then there's perhaps a murder mystery behind it and some whitewashing of history on the walls. It's kind of interesting. It's a solid.
Does it rock,
it's
Matt
a solid
Welch?
B. I wouldn't say it rocks. It suffers from the oftentimes mentioned problem of the executive producer's curse of documentaries these days. I didn't see that the executive producer was the Egyptian government, but it sure felt like it, because it was like it kept stressing, you know, this is only an Egyptian dig, and the kind of phony drama of it is like we had to finish the dig before Ramadan, and afterwards we're not sure if Ramadan was the funding was going to happen.
Does Israel come in for some bashing?
Sadly, no.
Slight bashing or frenemy territory?
There are moments of genuine, like moving transcendence of discovery. Like there's a great Egyptologist, mummologist, or whatever you call these people, who you get to watch her discover. And this is a spoiler alert, but it's been in the news. This is the first discovery of a mummified lion cub. So as she sees the little orange hair sticking out and realizes it's a lion, and like this opens up new entire kind of ethnographical intellectual vistas that she had never before thought possible. It's very moving. So solid B.
Matt, does your daughter have a opinion on the great mermaid controversy? Can there be Egyptian mermaids?
No, although I would point out that my colleague Camille Foster has just been insisting over and over again in the midst of this controversy that mermaids aren't real, which I think is a pretty brave stance. I'm not sure I'm ready to go all the way there yet, but he's apparently a mermaid abolitionist.
He's a mermaid denier. Get your terminology right, my man.
He just hasn't been at sea long enough.
Like all good Jamaicans. Anyways, it's pretty good. I'm very curious for people to email in, and some of you have already, recommendations about stuff I can watch with my seven-year-old. Specifically, if you have any great ancient civilizations things. What triggered her imagination was a thing that I'm sure I talked about before, a documentary called Angkor Wat, which we saw in California. Science and History Museum's fantastic, and I had no previous knowledge of it. I was like, what, really? So that was super great. So if you
I don't know if this might be a reach, Matt, but if she's into Egypt, I was watching also, and I chose not to talk about it, but the Kiss, there's a Kiss documentary That's available on Hulu. And there's a long section on how Vinnie Vincent became the Ankh. That was his symbol. So it ties in directly to mummified lion cub remains.
Reminds me of that great Little John song, Turn Down for Ankh or What?
We did come up with the plot. Coco's very favorite movie series is The Night in the Museum, and she's really bummed that there isn't a fourth coming, so we decided that they should do a reboot.
And we know what that will be, Matt.
A reboot with Timothée Chalamet in it and set it at the Louvre, and then, you know, the reanimated corpse of Napoleon strikes fear in the heart of contemporary geopolitics. I think it just writes itself. That's a pitch for funding. Speaking of pitch for funding, if you like what we do here at Reason, go to reason.com/donate. Want to listen to more of our podcasts, reason.com/podcasts. And other than that, we will hopefully see you if we all pass our COVID tests. I'm cramming for it later on. I will see you next time Monday. Okay, goodbye.